Welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Well, folks, we kept waiting for a player to make a move, and in the end, it was Russell Henley who did. The former Georgia Bulldog, that's right, Go Dogs, birdied his last three holes in regulation, then stuffed a wedge to 5 feet in the first playoff hole to defeat Eric Cole and win the Charles Schwab Challenge. Rex, you're out there at Colonial. It was hot. It was steamy. You looked very sunburned. What was the vibe like?
Yeah, I think it's the first time you and I are going to have a similar complexion. But mine is because I actually been in the
I have rosacea.
I'm sorry. I know. I've been told by HR I can't make fun of you for that. So I apologize. And you put the Bulldog shirt on even before Russell Henley made his move. I think you told me that in pre-production.
That's correct. Right. Georgia is in a must-win regional championship right now against Liberty that I was trying to will them to victory. I will be in Athens next week for a super regional if they can advance to this regional. So yes, I was very excited trying to will them to victory.
So you're going to be distracted for the next 15 to 20 minutes by that game. So I'm going to have to talk a lot. I got it. I understand Bingo. That's what you're talking about here. The fascinating thing for here, and we can break down, and I do want to get into the idea that this has not been a very good season for 54-hole leaders. This is now 13 54-hole leaders that did not close out on the PGA Tour this season. That's out of 22 events. So you can do the math and figure it out. And for the life of me, I couldn't, I can't give you a good reason why, but it is a fascinating stat other than to say, that's golf sometimes. But you said in your phrasing to start the show that someone finally broke free. Someone finally moved in and challenged Eric Cole for the lead. He didn't early. He was one over par through 10 holes. Russell Henley was not playing well to start his round. When I interviewed him after the fact on the green after the playoff, he said, I was frustrated. And he also admitted that this season, he goes, I've had a hard time dealing with my emotions, which is a little strange because when you watch him play, it doesn't seem like he has any emotions. However, in this particular case, you could see him getting frustrated. And I think there's a lesson there, and we've learned it. We've learned it, I think, the last few weeks, that even if you make a mistake, you don't have to play as well as you probably think you have to play on Sunday of a PGA Tour event to win. And this is a great example. All that being said, it also helps if you make 50 feet of putts over your last four holes. He birdied 16 from 15 feet. He birdied 17 in regulation from 15 feet. He birdied 18 from 16 feet. And then, of course, you talked about the wedge to 5 feet. That is a phenomenal stretch of golf for a player who is one of the best putters on the PGA Tour. But even that is something that I'm sure there's players sitting at home right now thinking to themselves, I can never do that. I would never be able to pull that off, to go four out of four to close out a tournament.
I mean, he absolutely stole the golf tournament. We weren't even paying attention to Russell Henley with an hour to go. I mean, I was looking up Eric Cole notes, looking up minor league golf results that he's had over the past 15 years, and all of a sudden pops in a 15-footer, pops in a 15-footer, pops in a 15-footer, and then does what he does in the playoff. I was hoping, Rex, in your post-round interview with Russell Henley, you would follow up on that question. Why have you struggled with your emotions at this point in your career? Keep in mind, 2025, I would really term it a breakout for Russell Henley. Got all the way to number four, career best ranking, and the official world golf ranking was challenging in major championships. He finished second at East Lake, the Tour Championship, in the FedEx Cup race, made his Ryder Cup debut alongside Scotty Scheffler, although he did have a poor experience there, did not pair very well with Scotty in the team format. Obviously was on the receiving end of a Shane Lowry heroics on 18 when he had a couple opportunities to earn what could have been a very, very pivotal point for the Americans. It has been a disappointing season. Did you get any answers as to why Russell Henley, even keeled Russell Henley, was struggling in that manner?
That was a very good observation for you. For journalism students should have paid attention because you're absolutely right. I should have followed up on that question and asked, why do you get so frustrated? And I did not. However, I do have a defense on this front because you have done these before, so you understand.
Oh, yeah.
Normally in these post-round interviews, when you have the champion, there's a lot going on, especially if there's a playoff and you're on the 18th green and they're being moved in all kinds of different directions. That was, if you want to go back and count, the fourth question. And you're usually limited to about three. So I had already gone past my speed limit. I had already ran through some stop signs, and John Bush from the PGA Tour was already starting to give me a dirty look. So I could not do the follow-up, which I should have done. And I'm sure maybe we'll hear about it more when we take a look at the transcript of what he was talking about. I don't put much stock into what happened to him last year at the Ryder Cup, simply because I don't think many Americans really enjoyed that experience. Maybe outside of JJ Spahn, and Cam Young, it being a home game for him. But even that seemed to be soured. I don't think many of the U.S. team played really well. So it's not as though I hang what happened last season on his shoulders. I think getting that victory at the Arnold Palmer Invitational was a huge step for him. My biggest takeaway was, and I was listening to the guys, and this is always fascinating, and you've heard it before, during commercials, during the live tournament coverage, I think it's so fascinating to listen to the analyst talk. And these are former players, and we're talking about Kurt Byram and you and I's best friend, AO, and all of these players who have been out there before. And to hear Kurt talk about, and this was Thursday morning, by the way, early coverage, talk about this is an absolutely perfect course for Russell Henley. Talking about how he hits the golf ball, the things he does well, if the winds come up, the way he putts, all of the things you need to do well at Colonial. He actually equated him to, and I think this was a good comp. Like, this is kind of a modern day Ben Hogan when you look at how he hits the golf ball, how he approaches the game. And this, of course, is one of three Hogan's alleys, but still, it's a Hogan's alley. I did ask Russell Henley what it means to win on this golf course, and there was a little bit of emotion in his voice. I think this shows you what it means for a player like that to win at a golf course that not only has so much history, but demands so much of your game, and to do it in that fashion. Like I said, one over through 10 holes. You started the day so far back. You essentially have 8 holes to sort of make your run. And to be able to pull that off, you don't get that opportunity very often on the PGA Tour. I think he was savoring that.
I want to get to the golf course eventually. I want to get to the setup, which I found to be absolutely spectacular on Sunday with the number of ejections and really putting a premium on placement and really having control of your golf ball. But because we did not get a direct answer from Russell Henley, I am left, Rex, to speculate about what potentially could have been the difference between 2025 and 2026. And again, it hasn't been a terrible year by any stretch of the imagination for Russell Henley. He did have 3 top tens. Keep in mind, he did have an opportunity to win the Masters, finished just a couple shots shy of Roy McIlroy, parred his last 5 holes, had his putter heated up. I think Russell Henley felt pretty confident he could have even won the tournament, or at the very least, been in a playoff with Roy McIlroy trying to win the Masters just a couple hours from his childhood home. I am left to wonder, though, Rex, because when you look at sort of the general theme of sort of the breakout candidates from 2025, I'm talking about a J.J. Spahn, talking about an Andrew Novak, talking about a Ben Griffin, certainly the defending champion last year at Colonial, who made a pretty spirited run to try to defend the title and get the challenger home this time. I do wonder if there is any sort of psychological hurdle that these players need to clear in the sense of how do you keep pushing and thinking that you need to get better as opposed to maybe realizing that, hey, this may have been the peak of my career. Like, is this me maxed out, or do I have something left to achieve? Obviously, these are the best players in the world. I think everyone would say, yeah, I have another level to attain. However, if you fast forward a decade from now, all of these players may look back and say, yeah, that was the high point. That was the highest I ever got in the Fisher World Golf Ranking. That was the most times I won in a season. That was the best by ball striking, the best putting I've ever had. Whatever the case may be, it's certainly possible 10 years from now, we may look at that. J.J. Spahn has acknowledged, Rex, that he had sort of added expectations this season, was really struggling with that, to adjust to that prior to winning the Valero Texas Open, where he finally just let himself be himself and sort of absorb some of the losses, take some of the pressure off of himself. Ben Griffin, he maybe want to sort of admit it, but you look at his results year over year. I know he said, look, I'm always tend to be a slow starter on the PGA Tour. This season statistically has been worse than last year. The results wise, at least to this point of the season, has been worse. You wonder about the expectations for a player who, again, had vaulted himself to the top 10 as well. Again, we don't know that definitive for Russell Henley, but I do wonder if there's anything sort of psychological, just trying to meet up to expectations either externally or certainly internally after hitting a high point in your career.
Very quick point of correction. It is a scrambler that they won this year, which is the coolest.
I thought it was a challenge. Oh, that's right. The scrambler.
It was last year. Yes. No, that was last year. I'm not even doing this to correct you. Normally I take so much joy in correcting you. That's not even what I'm doing right now. This is because this year's car was the one car that I'm like, I'm a Jeep guy and I wanted that so bad. Like, that car was phenomenal. And if I was Ben Griffin, who you alluded to this, so he won something called a Defender last year. It's kind of
Defender.
Yeah, I don't even know how I would describe it.
Clearly not a car guy. I'm more of a golf cart guy myself.
Well, you're more of a, yes, of a club golf cart guy and a, yes, exactly. And a smoker guy. So I'm going to let you off the hook on this one. But that car never made it to Ben Griffin from last year's victory. It burned up on the way. So he's yet to get that car. What you were referring to is if he were to win this year, he would get this year's car first and he would probably drive it home just to be safe, just to make sure. I don't want this one to burn up. I love this question because it is a fascinating case study in the mind of a champion. And it's a similar conversation or close to the conversation you and I had about Aaron Rye when he won the PGA Championship. Mm. I talked about the story when I met him, his rookie season on the PGA Tour at the RSM Classic, and sat down and did a pretty short interview. But I just was trying to get to know him a little bit. I said this. I walked away from that interview thinking to myself, like, yeah, he doesn't have that killer instinct. The nicest man on the planet. Like, oh, the really kind of guy is. I mean, just a lovely fellow, but I didn't see the killer instinct because, to answer your question, I don't think any of them right now in the middle of it, Ben Griffin being the best example. Actually, better example might be Ryan Gerard. Here is a player who has won on the PGA Tour and had a chance to win again today. But the conversations, the multiple conversations I had with him this week is trying to get that 1% better, doing the thing that I have to do. He talked about last week in his off week after the PGA Championship when he said he had hit rock bottom with his putting, spending hours and hours on the putting green, trying to find a way to fix it over the next 5 or 6 days, and arrived and found something. Like, he played well, and it wasn't just his ball striking this time around. I think in the heat of the moment, when they looked themselves in the mirror, absolutely not. They have not reached that point. However, and I'm not even saying this to be mean, because he was one of my dearest friends when he was on the PGA Tour. Some of these players are Gavin Coles, and Gavin Coles had a lovely PGA Tour career. For someone who hit it as far as he did, which was really towards the bottom of the PGA Tour average, I think he exceeded any expectations. I think he kept his tour card for 6 or 7 years, contended a couple times. Him and Vijay went head-to-head in Houston once, but never actually won, never broke through. Had some success, but never really broke through. I don't think any of them think of themselves in that light. All of them think that, nope, I'm 1 week away. Even Eric Cole. When I talked to him about this, the last question to him after losing that playoff was, do you feel like you're close? Even in that moment, it's like, I'm very close. And he had conceded, I still have to do it. I didn't get it done today, but he feels like he's very close. I think the mind of an athlete, and not just a PGA Tour player, any athlete, is always going to be that, no, I just got beat today. I can get this done. I can get over that hump.
It's hard to think of Russell Henley as an overachiever. You know, keep in mind, he went to Georgia. I went to Georgia. He was a couple years behind me. I mean, he was a prolific college winner, incredible amateur player, won on what was then the nationwide tour when he was still in college. I mean, won every award imaginable. Remember when he broke out at the Sony Open in his very first start as a PGA Tour member, wins that golf tournament. I do think, however, he's still, I think, an overachiever on today's PGA Tour, which is really tailor-made and built for power and distance and strength. Russell Henley is not that. He's very much a throwback player. Peppers fairways. He's a low ball hitter. That's why, at least until recently, he has really struggled in the major championships. He can be, and he really has improved his putting over the past couple of years, thanks to Phil Kenyon, who's the putting coach, to all the big stars on the PGA Tour. And I think what happened at Colonial, you talk about Kurt Byram and AO saying that this is an absolutely perfect golf course at Colonial for Russell Henley. No doubt about it. First in the field in fairways hit, first in the field in proximity of the hole, inside 27 feet for the weeks. I know these are not the biggest greens in the PGA Tour, but absolutely knocking down flagsticks all day long, which brings me, Rex, to the setup of the golf tournament. And when you and I talked, I was co-hosting Golf Today earlier this week with Damon Hack in Connecticut while you were doing your reports from Fort Worth. You talked about the rain and how the golf course was playing a little bit softer, a little bit wetter than I think probably the PGA Tour setup staff would have wanted. We've seen this place absolutely baked out. Last year's final round comes to mind where Ben Griffin really had to struggle and really had difficulty controlling his golf ball. I think there was maybe some hesitation earlier in the week. Look, the winning score is 21. Excuse me, the tournament record for score was 21 under par. Maybe that gets threatened because of the weather. 12 under par, Rex wins this golf tournament. I didn't hear any player, obviously you would know better than I would, I didn't hear any player kvetching about the setup, saying it's unfair, this place is tricked up, the whole locations are on too many slopes. I mean, this is such a great test and why Colonial has stood up for the test of time. It's been hosting PGA Tour events since the 1940s and why it needs to be protected in the new look, new age PGA Tour, because it is single-handedly one of the 10 best venues they come to all year. And I think the final round in particular where this golf course really shined was evidence of that.
You're going to get save Colonial pins and start wearing them around everywhere you go. I don't think this
tier one for life, baby.
Track one, absolutely. And I don't think this tournament, to be, we've talked a lot about this. I don't want to take a deep dive, but I don't think this will be a track two event. I think there's too much history there to point, to just finish up your point. This is the 80th playing of this event. And I took probably some shots at Gil Hanse. He's an architect that both you and I like, because I went to Frisco earlier in the week where they're going to have the PGA Championship next year. That's a Gil Hanse course. Gil Hanse also did some nips and tucks when it comes to Colonial. He also came in and did a little redesign there as well. Not one player is going to say anything bad about this golf course. And I will also go back to the conversation that you and I had on last Sunday night's podcast when we were talking about TPC Craig Ranch, 31 under par one there, and the pace of play was dreadful and not the kind of golf course that's overly enjoyable to watch. I didn't particularly have a problem with it because I like watching the best players in the world make birdies and eagles. But to your point, you know what I like more? The golf that we saw today at Colonial, the type of conditions. And you can look, to go back to our conversations earlier in the week, there was a lot of rain. But I think the last any kind of rain we had here was Tuesday night going into Wednesday morning. And the golf course just got firmer and faster and then baked out by the time they finished this afternoon. And that's when this golf course plays its absolute best. I don't think it's any surprise that Russell Henley probably didn't play his best golf Thursday and Friday, but he did on Saturday and Sunday, because you're right. He is tailor-made for this type of golf. He won the Sony Open again. Another old style, kind of a quirky golf course. The low ball flight's not going to hurt him there. It is a fascinating conversation to think about where he is in the world. And he is a world-class player at this point. However, if we went to Augusta National next week for the Masters, I don't think either you nor I would have him in, I'm being generous here, our top 10 to win because of that ball flight.
Although he almost did win the golf tournament 2 months ago. Again, that was by far his best result in the Masters tournament, but that is traditionally why he has struggled. And it's why I think his Open Championship record is a little bit surprising to me as well, with his improvements in his putting. Perhaps that can turn around in a couple of years. I'm with you, Rex, like wind, rough, firmer greens. I mean, it had everything, dog legs, trees. Like that is the perfect setup. And that is the perfect golf course. Like I think Sunday on the PGA Tour is exactly, if you held the PGA Tour at gunpoint, they would tell you that is what we want it to look like, right? Like that is exactly what we want. We want great scores to be in the mid-60s. We want there to be some ejections. We want there to be some mystery. We want there to be some consequence. It should matter hitting the ball in the fairway. It should matter hitting it hole high on some of the greens. It should matter being able to hold nervy 10 to 15 putts with a lot of slope on these greens, as they typically do at Colonial. I was blown away. I absolutely loved it. I would love to see more of it. Tier one, track one, Colonial for life. Fasas's finger is up, which means it is your turn.
Well, and I also made the comment last Sunday that TPC Craig Ranch was a different kind of test. And it was also a very slow test. There was a lot of comments about the place of play. And I pointed out that let's keep an eye on what happens at Colonial. This golf course was built for not just really fun and entertaining golf, but for speed. And I think the measure of this, because it's difficult to measure exactly how fast a golf course is relative to what we saw last week, but I was watching the telecast on Saturday afternoon, and the same thing happened Sunday, even with the playoff. They finished up play before CBS went off air, which means that normally the PGA Tour rules officials are brilliant at getting that absolutely right. They have figured out the science of how to structure tee times to make sure that last group is finishing off exactly at 6 p.m. Eastern time. And that's what they want. They need to finish. And they were about 10 minutes early on Saturday. And if not for the playoff, they would have been about 5 minutes early on Sunday. That is the best.
And that was with three balls. And that was with some, I mean, you did have some backup, certainly during the horseshoe.
Yeah, but you also factored in the idea that you teed them off early. And you're right. I mean, I think this as a test of golf is exactly what you want. And it's worth pointing out when we talk about track one and track two, and again, I don't think Colonial can in any universe would be a track two event, but Fort Worth is now a top 10 market in the United States. So this has every single ingredient that Brian Rolapp, the CEO of the PGA Tour, has talked about. It's got the history. It's got the great venue. It's got sort of that lore, that everything that goes into what you want to see out of a good tournament. It's also a major market, and it's also loved by the community. Like, Fort Worth embraces this thing. It's a show. So I think it's safe for me to say this will be a track one event.
Rex, can we pour one out for Eric Cole, who lost in the playoff, who, got to be honest, over the last 2 hours of the golf tournament, it did not seem like he did a whole lot wrong. And I thought, at least until his approach took a little bit of a squirrely bounce with his approach into 72nd hole, or at least until Russell Henley went nuclear over the final hour of this golf tournament, it looked like he was finally going to win at age 37 for the very first time on the PGA Tour. I know you were hustling. You wanted to get Ben Griffin and Alex Smalley and Mac Meisner, Gary Woodland, Michael Brennan, all those guys on tape for interviews for Golf Central, but you were unable to do so. But you did, Rex, have an opportunity to speak with Eric Cole. How did he take, again, what I would describe him to be a pretty hard-look loser in this case, not doing a whole lot wrong?
Steve Sands on the telecast read the email that all of us got when it has the tour notes in it that pointed out that every single rookie of the year since the beginning of time, and I think that's 30-something rookies of the year, so the Arnold Palmer Trophy winners, of those 30-something winners, only one has never won on the PGA Tour before, and that's Eric Cole. And I'm not amazing even saying
stat.
That.
Amazing stat.
It is an amazing stat, because you look at what he did that season. I remember talking with Eric at the Tour Championship and being like, of course he's the rookie of the year. I think he had 7 top 10 finishes. He had a really good chance of winning the Cognizant Classic. And I think Chris Kirk won it that year. He had plenty of opportunities. And at that point, it felt like, of course, he's going to break through. I think, two things. One, it's a testament to how hard it is to win on the PGA Tour. He gave himself a good chance. And we were talking about this as he was finishing up. So someone mentioned to me that, oh, Eric Cole has to birdie the 17th hole to have a chance. And my response was, do they have to win by 2 now on the PGA Tour? I don't understand that. And the point this person was trying to make is Eric's never really performed when he's been in this situation. And he hasn't, at least not on the PGA Tour. I kind of did my Sal Palantonio thing this morning on the pregame show. And because there's no newspapers anymore, I had to hold up a website. And it came from golf.com. And the headline was, veteran puts himself into the hunt at Colonial, comma, now comes the hard part. And that's the part I leaned into, that he had done all the hard work to give himself a chance to win what would be the biggest event of his career, considering everything he's accomplished in his career. Because it's not as though Eric Cole, he keeps his tour card, he makes it to the tour championship. He's done some phenomenal things in his career, but the headline, now comes the hard part. And for the vast majority of the day, if you go and look at it statistically, his ball striking wasn't as sharp on Sunday that it had been, at least two rounds. But the part that gave me solace, and it gave me a little bit of confidence that this was going to be Eric Cole's day, because coming down the stretch, he made 7 putts from 5 feet or more, which leads you to believe that, okay, he's converting.
He's handling his nerves. Yep.
He's handling the pressure, because that's where it's going to manifest itself. You can make the opposite argument, I guess, in this situation and say that, well, he shouldn't be giving himself 5-foot putts to make pars, but it's a really hard golf course, all the things we pointed out. And again, the stupid radio debate, sports radio debate. Did he win? Did he lose? I can make a really good argument. Russell Henley won this. He birdied his last 4 holes.
He stole it.
Come on.
Russell Henley stole the golf tournament.
And I'll go back to what Eric Cole told me, that yes, absolutely close, and he's learning every step of the way, but it doesn't get any easier.
No, it certainly doesn't, and I think this one will sting, yes, but I think for different reasons. And yeah, you may look back at what happened on the 9th hole, made double bogey there after taking on a shot over the water that he probably shouldn't have in hindsight, just because a little bit of a muffled lie.
But he still had the lead. It's not like he bounced out of the lead.
I mean, he dropped down into a tie for the lead, but he played one under the house. Like, I think he felt like he was in control of the golf tournament. And you talk about how difficult it is to win on the PGA Tour, and this was proof of that. Eric Cole's story, Rex, is proof that it's really difficult to make it to the PGA Tour. Keep in mind, this is a guy who turned pro in 2009, went a decade without even making it all the way to the Corn Ferry Tour. Had just become a mini tour legend. He's notched more than 60 wins on that circuit. He still plays some of the minor league golf events in the offseason to stay sharp. Like, this is a guy who loves to compete. He loves to play golf tournaments. Why that's important on the PGA Tour, I think, shows in sort of his record. And I did a story a couple years ago about players that I described as being volume shooters on the PGA Tour. And by that, I meant they're playing more than 30 events, trying to compile as many FedEx Cup points as possible and see where that falls at the season long in the season long standings. And it was, I think, like Patrick Rogers is in that list. Eric Cole was in that list. Players who, again, over the past 3 years, he had played 37, 34, and 32 events. This season on the PGA Tour, he has played 13 times. In other words, he has played every single tournament for which he was eligible. So at this point, he had not been eligible for signature events and none of the major championships as well. He's a very interesting story in that way, because that is those are the players that the PGA Tour is essentially trying to get rid of, right? Like, there was pushback at the time a couple years ago that these guys are gaming the system. I would always argue that, sure, he is giving himself more chances than a Scottie Scheffler or a Rory McIlroy. But I also think it's really difficult to play 35 times a season on the PGA Tour. Like, you could play that many times, but if that doesn't suit your schedule, that doesn't suit your body, that doesn't suit your game, it doesn't matter. You'll just continually miss cuts. You'll continually finish in a tie for 50th and not accrue points that way. The fact that Eric Cole has been able to play this rigorous of a schedule, accrue as many points as he is, and play as consistently well as he has, I think deserves to be applauded. Again, especially for a player who ball striking wise just really doesn't stand up to his PGA Tour peers. Not only is he short, he's outside the top 125 in driving distance on the PGA Tour. He's inaccurate. He hits 48, 49% of his fairways while hitting it short. Short and crooked is typically not a recipe for success on the PGA Tour, and yet Eric Cole has carved out a pretty good living for himself.
I would think Patrick Reed fell in that category as well. I don't remember reading that story of yours, but P. Reed was a volume shooter on that front. I don't think anybody would.
He was also on Live at the time, but yeah, he would have certainly been included at the time.
So, and I'm going to push back a little bit. I don't think the PGA Tour is trying to get rid of those players. I think what the PGA Tour is trying to whittle down what the best number is for fields. And if we land at 120 or 130, I know we don't want to get into what the schedule might look like going forward, but there is a scenario where there would be plenty of space on the PGA Tour for the Eric Coles of the world. And look, you talked about Scottie Scheffler's schedule, and I think most of the modern stars are going to play a limited schedule, Rory McIlroy being the primary example here. I think a lot of those players are feeding off what Tiger Woods did at the height of his career, where there was a 15 or 16 event schedule that he pretty much stuck to for his entire career. And if it worked for Tiger, then it's probably going to work for me. That's not the case for everyone. I think Eric Cole is an interesting example here, because you're right on one level. I remember having a conversation with a player a few years ago talking about top 25 was the magic number. If you could just top 25 every single event you play over the course of the year, the player was Charles Howell III, by the way, so he played a lot as well. He would have been on your list. That would be good enough points-wise to get you all the way to Eastlake. That is probably not what Brian Rolep and the PGA Tour want. They don't want someone to aim for the middle of the pack. That's not the idea at all. But I don't think Eric Cole is that type of person, I guess is my point.
No, I don't think he's that type of person, but he's that type of player. At least he has been to this point, where he just wants to give himself as many opportunities to accrue points. What the PGA Tour model, at least it looks like it's going to be, is everyone has a fair shot, right? You're going to have 15 to 18 tournaments, whether you're on tier one, track one, or whether you're on tier two, track two. You got 18 to 20 tournaments. That's where you need to make your hay. And most likely, all of the players who are eligible for those tournaments are going to play them. All of a sudden, you're not just going to be running yourself ragged, trying to earn as many starts as possible to earn as many points. Everyone is going to play the exact same number, and however it shakes out at the end of the year, the top 50, the top 70, the top 100 players to keep their card, that's what it's going to be. That's the scenario I think the PGA Tour is trying to avoid. They're trying to get rid of mediocrity being rewarded and trying to identify the best of the best and be the most cutthroat competitive product on the planet. I don't think that's necessarily the wrong direction that the PGA Tour should be going. And Eric Cole, to his credit, has done enough over the past couple of years to keep his card. Again, a hard luck loser at Colonial, but hopefully his time is coming. All right, that is going to do it for our Charles Schwab Challenge wrap. Coming up after the break, some putt shots. We're going to talk about Bryson DeChambeau. We're going to talk about the U.S. Women's Open, as well as Scottie Scheffler and Rory McIlroy finally playing in a PGA Tour event together. Stay with us. All right, Rex, Bryson DeChambeau did not get the win at LIV Korea, but he did have a pretty interesting revelation after the final round. Again, his crushers did win the team title, and he lost by a shot individually to Joaquin Niemann. Bryson said that he has been working with Google's Gemini to fix his swing. Do you think that's smart, or do you think that that's indicative of a player who has lost his way?
I jokingly sent a very good friend of ours who's a swing coach on the PGA Tour a text and said, AI is even taking your job. Look what's happening here. I think it's a little comical, and I'm not even trying to dismiss this whole idea because I'm sure there is something there. I'm sure there's a lot of smart people in Silicon Valley trying to figure out how to turn AI into the perfect swing coach. But in this particular case, of all the things that AI could have told Bryson DeChambeau, all of the technical issues and pressure and what you're trying to do, he was trying to close the club face, essentially what he was trying to do. And the advice was just don't hold the club so tight, loosen your grip. You and I have heard that advice 3,000 times in our career. Anyone who's ever touched a golf club has heard that advice. That is the only thing your drunk buddies will tell you on a tee box when you hit a bad shot. Either that or you look up. So either one of those things are kind of ridiculous. Yes, you should have a light grip. Yes, I'm sure AI nailed that one. I'm sure that somehow that resonated with Bryson DeChambeau to go out and actually play a decent round. He actually said in his comments following that final round that, no, it's not fixed. No,
didn't fix him. Did not fix him.
Still, it did not fix him, shockingly, with that kind of advice. You don't know how that he could possibly go wrong. This is just another chapter in Bryson DeChambeau being maximum Bryson DeChambeau, where he could have just as easily sat in front of a microphone and said that I'm struggling with my game. It just wasn't there. I'm going to keep working. The idea that Bryson, of course, would go to AI to get the fix. I will give our colleague at golfweek.com, Adam Shupak, credit. He wrote a really good column pointing out that instead of AI, he maybe just should go back to Mike Scheer, who, of course, is Mike Shea, who, Mike is, of course, shy. Got it right. Got it wrong twice. Look at me. The idea being that they split up. It wasn't a very pretty split up, but this was almost like a father figure to Bryson, at least when it came to golf. And like maybe he does need someone in there. We have seen too many videos of Bryson just grinding away into the darkness at Augusta and anywhere else, trying to find answers. And he's like every golfer, but he takes it to the extreme. And this is just another example of that.
Yeah, Mike Shy has been with Bryson for 25, 30 years at this point, has probably seen him hit more golf balls than anybody. And even at this stage of his career and their relationship, he would have been more sort of a consultant or an advisor. But it's pretty clear that Bryson, I watched him firsthand at Aronimink after his rounds at the PGA Championship, like absolutely searching for something. And again, it was a messy divorce. There's some financial components involved as well in that situation. It would be Bryson most likely needing to sort of apologize for how it's gone down and sort of let bygones be bygones. But at this point, with the searching, it certainly appears, Rex, like he could use a sounding board. And it wasn't Gemini, not ChatGPT. It wasn't Claude. None of these people are going to help him. A full-blown swing coach. I know he's been working with Dana Dahlquist as well over the past couple of years, but it might be time for Bryson DeChambeau to find a different direction. And again, it's his iron play that tends to be the issue. This golf course in Korea, this coming week at Valderrama, these are very confining venues. You look at Bryson DeChambeau's driving distance over the week in Korea, it was about 280 yards. So he's scaling back and trying to attack a golf course that way. Is still not comfortable. Something tells me at Shinnecock for the U.S. Open, on those greens, in that wind, you better have complete control of your golf ball. And the time is running out for Bryson DeChambeau to be ready for that sort of test. All right, we talked about this a little bit on the midweek podcast, but it's worth revisiting that the 2027 Florida Swing is going to be undergoing a pretty significant makeover, with Doral and the Cadillac Championship moving up is going to be the lead-in event to the Players Championship, while the Arnold Palmer Invitational at Bay Hill is actually going to be moving back the week following TPC Sawgrass and the PGA Tour's flagship event. You've been talking to players all week at Fort Worth. How much is next year's Florida Swing top of mind for them? And does it sort of foreshadow anything about the PGA Tour's future, or is this sort of a one-off and a transition year?
Oh, hold on. I had an idea. I'm asking AI. Bryson DeChambeau. Sorry, bad joke. I don't know. The only thing that really stood out to me from that schedule, well, two things stood out to me, and you're right. The Florida Swing is going to be interesting because now you're kicking off with the Cognizant Classic, which has been the normal start to the event. But then you go to Doral, a signature event, or Siggy, as you like to call it. Then you go to the Players Championship, obviously the fifth major, and then you go to the Bay Hill, which is a signature event, Siggy. The idea that these players are going to play 3 weeks in a row, and not these aren't, this isn't normal, a normal 3 weeks in a row. It's Doral. It's TPC Sawgrass. It's Bay Hill. They're brutes. And I think of that lineup, Bay Hill is going to take the hit. And you could probably make the argument as we go through the schedule going forward that someone is going to be a loser in this scenario. Talking with players, I think there's some themes emerging that if the PGA Tour schedule does turn into what Brian Rolapp wants it to turn into, there's a couple of ideas that seem to be surfacing. And one of them is they don't want to play more than 3 weeks in a row. And if he can find a way to build in off weeks around those on the shoulder programming, then yes, that would absolutely work. But in 2027, Bay Hill's going to take the hit. And whether that means that Scottie Scheffler or Rory McIlroy or whatever combination of stars don't show up there, that seems like what's going to happen because they're not going to get beat up. They're not going to get punched in the face for three straight weeks on those difficult golf courses with the Masters, the year's first major around the corner. Now, I will say, as I'm critical of this particular part of the schedule, the part of the schedule that I was impressed with is they found a way to move the CJ Cup Nelson away from that, what would have been another brutal stretch, because you have the PGA Championship, which will be in Frisco, Texas, as I said, followed by this week's event, the Charles Schwab Challenge. There's no way that you could have had 3 weeks in a row, not just on those golf courses, but in the exact same market. So they did find a way to move around the schedule. You look at the Valspar Championship in Tampa. They moved that out of the Florida swing. It probably won't help in the grand scheme of things with the field. It's obvious this is just a transition year, but you cannot like what this is going to do to Bay Hill.
Yeah, look, if you zoom out, it's six huge events in a seven-week span, which is actually one more than we had in 2026 when all the players were talking about how, you know, how tired they are at the end of the Florida swing and, you know, how grueling the stretch is in the run-up to the Masters. I do think players generally like to be tested ahead of the year's first major. And at that point, you can just sort of cruise the remainder of the major championship season. Something's got to give, though. Maybe Phoenix takes a little bit of a hit in the schedule. I certainly think, to your point, the Arnold Palmer Invitational coming off of the PGA Tour's flagship event is going to hurt. I still don't quite understand, again, this is just looking at Florida, why you would not go Doral, Bay Hill, TPC Sawgrass, and then Cognizant on the back end, if for no other reason than geographical reasons and just climbing up the state. Again, the Cognizant has sort of gotten the short straw each of the past couple of years coming off of the West Coast swing, and maybe that's sort of the rationale, that you're giving the guys a breather, you're providing other playing opportunities, you're giving the big guys, even though most of them live in South Florida, they've shown a hesitancy to support that hometown tournament and the PGA National, whatever the reason is, as it relates to the golf course. Put that one on the back end of the Players' Championship, and it might be a little bit of a different story. All right, speaking of signature events, Rex, we finally have Scottie Scheffler and Rory McIlroy teeing it up together at the Memorial Tournament coming up this week at Jack's Place. A pretty amazing stat, because this is the first time that Rory and Scottie have been together in a regular PGA Tour event since the Arnold Palmer Invitational in mid-March. So that's excluding the Players. That's excluding the major championships. This is just three times on tour this season that those top two players have been on tour together, and six times overall when you include the major championships. What do you think of that situation?
I feel like there's a lot of caveats in that stat of yours. You seem to be very impressed with it.
Six times overall, we've had the top two stars in the PGA Tour playing in the same golf tournament together. Again, we're more than halfway through the PGA Tour season.
And I think this is a byproduct of what you and I just sussed through with the idea that players aren't going to do this. They're not going to play Doral, TPC, and Bay Hill, or whatever combination is the PGA Tour comes up with. In this particular case, it's Rory McIlroy has been clear, doesn't particularly like to play Hilton Head the week after the Masters. For whatever reason, maybe the golf course just doesn't fit him. Scottie Scheffler has been clear, going into the PGA Championship, Charlotte probably just wasn't a very good fit. It's a little weird. He had won the PGA Championship the year before.
He doesn't want to play the week before the PGA Championship. I think
exactly, which leads to the other sort of equation or the other sort of truth that I came up with this week, talking with players about what they'd like to see with the new schedule. Don't want to play 3 weeks in a row. And if they had to choose between either taking the week off before a major or the week after the major off, it's going to be after. And suddenly you put Scottie Scheffler in a situation where, okay, you're going to make them play Charlotte or wherever the case may be. I think this is just another example of how difficult this is going to be for Brian Rolapp. This particular stat doesn't surprise me, because Rory is going to make certain decisions and Scotty is going to make certain decisions that I would say numbers 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, everyone else behind him probably aren't. Guys are going to skip maybe from time to time, but these two players have made it clear Scotty doesn't want to play the week before a major, in this case the PGA Championship. Rory doesn't want to play Hilton Head.
That's why I do not envy the members of the Future Competitions Committee, again, some of whom are active players on the PGA Tour, because you're trying to decide for the overall membership what is going to work best. What's the best cadence for all these players? The best players in the world, I think, have even a different schedule than some of the superstars of the PGA Tour. And I'm talking about Rory McIlroy and Scottie Scheffler. Rory, in particular, I think, is a particularly dangerous player to try to game plan around and to strategize around. Counting on him in any future scenario in terms of playing opportunities and when it's going to happen and the golf courses and the tournaments, it's just really, really tricky. He's an international player who has made no bones that he absolutely loves playing on the DP World Tour and really cherishes those opportunities, particularly at the end of the year when he can give back to the tour that gave him his start. And so he's not going to play certain tournaments. I think he proved, Rex, heading into the Masters this year when you and I were lambasting him at every chance that he needed to add a start in between the Players' Championship and the Masters. Nah, I'm good, fam. I'm good taking 3 weeks off, heading into a major championship and winning that one, skipping signature events, skipping tournaments in sort of a chunk or a block. And so I think it's really, really difficult how they're going to map it out. But again, I think it is a sign of the times that even though these signature events were marketed and built on the idea we want to get the best players in the world together more often, this will be just the fourth time this year, 2026. Again, it's June 1, fourth time all year that Scotty and Rory are going to be together. All right, in non-PGA Tour news, a couple of big-name tournaments going on this week. Top college studs are competing at the NCAA Championship. We spent some time on this podcast talking about Jackson Koivin of Auburn, who already has a PGA Tour card in hand thanks to the PGA Tour University Accelerator Program, as well as Ben James, who is closing in on a PGA Tour card as well by virtue of the PGA Tour University rankings, which go to the top graduating senior. He holds a 25-point lead over Christian Moss of Texas. Why is that important? Because, Rex, the number one player gets a PGA Tour card. Number two player, you're headed to the Korn Ferry Tour for a year and a half. So what has your attention on Monday at La Costa as all this gets sussed out on the individual race?
I'm going to make this quick because you are the expert. You're the best college reporter in the entire business. So I'm going to leave you the floor on this one. I will say I texted numerous agents this afternoon because I was curious when it comes to Koivin about the decision he has over the next few weeks. If he remains an amateur, he, of course, has exemptions into the U.S. Open and the Open Championship. He could turn pro immediately after the NCAA Championships and pick up his PGA Tour card because, as you just pointed out, the PGA Tour accelerated program. And I'm trying to figure out why would you do one or the other. I guess the split would be, okay, play Shinnecock, the U.S. Open, but don't wait around the entire month to play the British Open. Turn pro and try to get in as many events as you possibly can. The idea being that you would get into at least one signature event. The Travelers Championship has been kind to these players. My guess is they would love to have Jackson Koivin in that field. Or you can go ahead and wait around to the Open Championship. You're going to have your PGA Tour card in 2027 regardless. The consensus was that I got back, because I do believe in this, is give yourself as many at-bats as you possibly can. It's what the conversation you and I just had. There's a reason why your best hitter hits leadoff on a baseball team. By the way, how are the Bulldogs doing? You want They're to give him
6-1 in the eighth. Thank you very much.
You want to give that player as many at-bats as possible. So if I was Jackson Koivin, I would probably turn pro sooner rather than later, because you're going to get plenty of starts between now and the end of the year. And that only gives you more opportunity to improve your status for next year, 2027. It's a great tour card you have, but you can get a better one if you play well the rest of the year. That would be the play.
Yeah, very, very interesting scenario. And Jackson Koivin is a finalist for the Nicklaus Award. Typically, that player also receives an exemption into the Memorial Tournament. So he obviously is trying to compete. He's trying to win an NCAA individual title, something he has not yet accomplished in his Auburn career. He's trying to win a team title with Auburn. That would end on Wednesday in La Costa. And obviously the Memorial Tournament starts on Thursday. If he does not, he could win the award and potentially not play in the tournament, in which case he could then defer that to next year. Regardless, he has already proven at a PGA Tour level that this guy has the goods. It's been an epic college journey, epic college season as well. Cannot wait to see what he does. I also think there's another feather in the cap, Rex, for the PGA Tour University program. I think it's been a massive success since it was rolled out a couple years ago. I think that program, coupled with the changing atmosphere and changing landscape in college sports with NIL, you can really make a lot of money. You can really learn. You can really play against the top competition on these difficult golf courses, make a name for yourself so that you are as prepared as humanly possible when you set out on your PGA Tour journey. And finally, Rex, the U.S. Women's Open, presented by Ally, is heading to Riviera this week for the very first time. A couple interesting storylines. Nelly Korda trying to, I don't know, win the single season slam. She already won the Chevron Championship, one of her three victories this season. Gino Titikin, the world number two, has not yet won a major championship, which is surprising as well. You also have Lottie Wode bursting on the scene, won a couple of weeks ago on the LPGA, as well as Lydia Ko, trying to have perhaps a capstone to her legendary career by winning at Riviera. What has your attention this week in LA?
All those are great stories, but what I really want to see is the best in the women's game play that particular golf course. Riviera is a regular stop on the PGA Tour. It's one of those stops, just like Colonial, that you and I just talked about. Another Hogan's Alley, actually, where every year you look forward to it. You know the golf holes, you know the history there, and this is such a great opportunity. When the U.S. Open and the U.S. Women's Open were held back-to-back at Pinehurst, I found that so fascinating because it tied the game together so well because you had the best women in the world and the best men in the world competing on the same golf course. I can't wait to see how Lydia Ko plays the 10th hole, which we talk about every single year. It's the golf course for me.
Couldn't agree more. Golf course and venue are so important, especially for the women's game. I think that's as important as any factor in helping increase the stature of these golf tournaments. I mean, it immediately elevates these tournaments because there's, as you mentioned, instant recognizability, which is so helpful for the viewer. We've seen Scotty and Rory and Tiger and Adam Scott and all the world's best play these shots before, and now you're going to have the very best in the women's game. I think when you also look ahead to some of the future venues for the U.S. Women's Open, Inverness, Oakmont, Pinehurst, Oak Hill, Chicago Golf Club, Marion, I mean, those are all on the upcoming rota for the U.S. Women's Open. We're not going to get into discussion about the cathedrals of a sport because that's how you got in trouble with the fine people in Newtown Square, Pennsylvania. However,
I don't like the way that was portrayed.
Bringing the U.S. Women's Open to these classic elite golf courses. I love the strategy from the U.S. GA. I love the strategy for the U.S. Women's Open. I will be tuned in and you and I will have a recap next week after the U.S. Women's Open. All right, that is going to do it for our punch shots. After this short break, you had a lot of questions. We got answers for you. Voices in the Crowd is coming up next. Pound Ask Rex. All right, Rex, let's get out of here. And this Voices in the Crowd submission, this one from Mark Edwards, who said, why do the majors even need to keep pace in the prize pool race with other golf tournaments? Why not, I don't know, make a $10 million purse for the U.S. Open instead of trying to go a $20 million plus?
Easy answer. Players are greedy. And I think what we've seen on the grand scale is the players are going to play the U.S. Open. They're going to play the Masters. Of course they are. But you don't want to cause the distraction of playing for $10 million versus a signature event, which is $20 million. So, no, I don't see them scaling it back. Now, they might come to some sort of detente, the PGA Tour and the major championship bodies, because you can't allow this escalating war to continue.
I do think it's an interesting thought exercise because I do agree with you that you could have a $100 purse for the U.S. Open and you would not have a single player who would not sign up. I do understand that. However, USGA's Mike Wan was asked about this last year ahead of the U.S. Open, and we're all anticipating the purse elevating again this year at Shinnecock. He said, quote, we want the money, the tournament, to be commensurate with the achievement. That, I think, is the viewpoint that's gotten us into this mess to begin with, where the PGA Tour was trying to keep up the arms race and live golf, and all of a sudden you have $3.6 million going to the winner of, say, the Travelers Championship, where I don't think anyone would agree would be commensurate with the achievement of winning the Masters. There needs to be some sort of reset. Maybe even the major championships could all be hand in hand with this and say, okay, we're all going to have a $10 million purse. We're all going to have a $50 million purse, whatever it is, and just have a purse across the board in unison for the major championships. But I'm with you. It's a little bit out of whack at the moment. This one from Jim Iverson, who said, what Rex is missing, Rex, is that the tournaments are mostly TV events. In-person attendance doesn't matter as much. This, of course, is in rebuttal to your PGA Championship talk.
What Jim is missing is that 10,000 fewer people a day on the golf course at the PGA Championship. And that's what the number was. 10,000 people fewer per day is an enormous amount of revenue for an organization that desperately needs that revenue. You can sit and argue that it's a TV event. And I think you can make a good argument that in many sports, the NBA probably being the primary one, where it really doesn't matter what the in-game experience is. That's not where they're getting their primary revenue. That's not the case in golf. The Masters makes an enormous amount of money in merchandise, what they do. The PGA Championship makes an enormous amount of money. They need that money to continue doing what the PGA of America does.
The gifts that keep on giving, the post-PGA Championship podcast show because of Rex's takes. Thank you so much. I hope this never ends. How about this one, Rex, from Golf, Barbecue, and Watch, who said, all of your schedule speculation talk is getting bored. And so, Rex, we have a solution. We have not talked barbecue in a while, clearly Golf, Barbecue, and Watch. Is this what appeal to them? What do you have to offer this week?
This is going to even be a more unpopular opinion because anytime you talk about barbecue, people are very serious. But when it comes to barbecue in Fort Worth, I think it is so underrated. You and I talk endlessly. One of us will be in Memphis this year for the FedEx playoff event. And one of us will inevitably talk about all the great places we went and ate barbecue. I would stack Fort Worth up to Memphis. And again, I know you're going to come at me. I know my DMs are going to be filled. But I had some of the best barbecue meals I've had in a long time. I went to Terry Black's. I had brisket there. I had the turkey, which, by the way, don't sleep on the turkey. It's delicious. I went to Himes today on the golf course. It was phenomenal. I got burnt ends. Bacon burnt ends. Might be the best thing I've ever had.
My goodness. I might have to have the Charles Schwab Challenge on my docket for 2027. Never been to Dallas.
No, you're not taking that.
No, I want Texas barbecue in my life, even though if my doctor would strongly advise me against doing so. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Golf Joe Podcast with Rex and Lav. We'll be back on Wednesday for a full preview of the Memorial, as well as the U.S. Women's Open and anything else that happens in the world of golf. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days.